Well, again, good morning to you. We are pressing onward in our study of the book of Job, which we have just begun last Sunday. And I must confess to you that in my life as a pastor and as a student of the Word of God, I have had a few aha moments. And by that, I mean those times when all of a sudden some truth hits you, and it's like all of a sudden the pieces of a puzzle fall into place. I remember when my eyes were opened to the truths of God's sovereign grace and how it was like all of a sudden an epiphany. All of a sudden the answers to so many questions fell into place. I have had a similar moment with the book of Job. In realizing something that was right under my nose, and that's the way it is with God's truth. It's never new truth. It's just truth that we have ignored or overlooked. But something that was right under my nose, that the book of Job is not what we normally think it is, a treatise on suffering. And if you treat it as a treatise on suffering, you will come to the end of the book scratching your head just as befuddled as you were when you began the book. And the realization that this is not really a treatise about suffering, it is a treatise on legalism. And that has opened up a whole new perspective for me on this book, and so many, many pieces have fallen into place. And I hope that some of my excitement can be conveyed to you this morning. We are in Job, the second chapter. We will take that chapter as our text this morning. Would you follow as I read it? Job chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God, a phrase that speaks of the angels, came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. Notice that has already happened back in chapter 1 in verse 6. And the Lord said unto Satan, From whence comest thou? And Satan answered the Lord and said, From going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil? And still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movest me against him to destroy him without cause. And Satan answered the Lord and said, Skin for skin. Yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thine hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, he is in thine hand, but save his life. So went Satan forth from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown, that is the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd, that's a piece of broken pottery. He took a potsherd with which to scrape himself, and he sat down among the ashes. Then said his wife unto him, Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die. But he said unto her, Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, the shortest man in the Bible, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, for they had made an appointment together to come mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice and wept, and they rent every one his mantle and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spoke a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. Last week we were introduced to this man, Job. We saw several things about him. First of all, when he lived, most likely during the age of the patriarchs, long before Moses, long before the law was given from Mount Sinai. He is a good man. God describes him as being perfect. And again, I would point out to you that this is not speaking of sinless perfection. We know that two ways. Theologically, no man born of Adam is sinlessly perfect. And number two, this perfect man here in chapter 1 is repenting of sin in the last chapter. Where does sin come from? Sin doesn't come from without, it comes from within. That is the clear teaching of our Lord. So it's not speaking of sinlessly perfect, but it is talking about outward blamelessness. Paul uses exactly those same words to describe his prior life, prior to his conversion, as a Torah-keeping, law-keeping Pharisee, that he was blameless as touching the law. There was no defect that you could point to and say, there, you have outwardly violated the law of Moses. He's a family man, 7 sons, 3 daughters. He's a rich man, the greatest man of the East, the richest man of the East. And he's a religious man. Just in the chance that his children have sinned, he offers burnt sacrifices for them. But then we are introduced to a scene that transpires unseen to Job, that transpires in the heavens between God and Satan. We remember how God points Job out to Satan. That's interesting, isn't it? Wasn't that Satan came along and said, man, I see that old fellow Job. I'd love to sink my hooks into him. But God says, have you considered my servant Job? That's like saying, seek him to your watchdog. And so Satan immediately goes to work and he attacks Job. His name, Satan, means the opposer. And he begins to do what he does best, to accuse us before the judgment seat of God Almighty. He begins to slander him. And in the process, he's not only slandering Job, but he's slandering God. The insinuation is that Job is, of course, serving you, but he's doing it for the stuff, for the blessings that you have showered upon him so abundantly. You put a hedge about him. You won't let anything touch him. No harm will come to him. Take it away, and he'll curse you to your face. Now, notice, this is not only a slander against Job, it is a slander against God. That your servants are serving you. Well, of course they are. They want the stuff. They don't love you for you. They love you for yours, for what you give them. Take it away and they will no longer serve you. In fact, they will curse your name. So Satan is allowed to take Job's substance. And he's very good at it once he's given permission. In a day, all of a sudden, his sheep, his camels, his oxen, his asses, and in fact, his children are all taken from him in a few moments' time, and he is reduced to nothing. And yet, Job responds in an amazing statement. Chapter 1, verse 21. Naked came I out of my mother's womb, naked shall I return thence. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Round one is over, and the score is 1-0. God won, Satan nothing. Job, God's servant, has hit one out of the park. But the game is not over. Now it's time for round two. And we're going to learn this is going to be a long, long contest and a long fight. Today in our text, we see a heavenly convocation, the synagogue, the assembly of God in the moral universe and His angels, assembling themselves before the throne of God Almighty. There is a second encounter and discourse between between Satan and God. God, we see here, is boasting. Do you see this? Look at my servant Job. He's still serving me. You took everything he had away. He's still my boy. He's still my guy. God glorying in the fidelity of his servant. But Satan wishes to double down. He wants to up the ante. He said, well, okay, but let me touch him. You wouldn't let me touch him. Let me touch him, and he will curse you to his face. And once again, God gives Satan permission, authority, to do just that. And again, when Satan is given permission, he does a pretty good job. Notice that God says you can touch his body, but you cannot touch his life. You cannot take his life. And so Job is smitten with this horrible affliction. I can't even imagine what this must have been like. Smitten with boils from the sole of your feet to the crown of your head, sitting in a pile of ashes, scraping yourself with a broken piece of pottery, the scabs and the pus and the... Shall I go on? You get the picture. It is a picture of utter misery. And then we meet Job's wife. I've sometimes said God took away from him everything he loved and left his wife. Well, his wife is spared, and spared for a very good reason. She has a very integral role to play here. She will become part of the trial. And I'm sure she meant well. I mean, I can almost hear her after Job has lost absolutely everything he owns, all his herds, his flocks, his children, everything's gone. He's reduced to nothing. He's been the richest man. He's been the... Warren Buffett of his day. And he's reduced to nothing. And I can almost hear his wife saying, but honey, you still have your health. You know, it's okay. You still have your health. And now that's taken. And his health crumbles and he's smitten with an affliction that is nothing but a living death. Worse than death. There are certain things, by the way, that are worse than death. And so now comes his wife, as it were, turning up the heat, ratcheting up the trial another notch or two. Because you see, till now, it was possible. It was just possible that maybe Job is experiencing these things by what we sometimes call collateral damage. You know, maybe he's really innocent. Maybe it's not really Job that is, but maybe his children have blasphemed God. Maybe his children aren't as righteous as we're led to believe they are. Maybe the house has collapsed on them because of their sin. And maybe Job's cattle have got anthrax or something. Maybe his servants have been beating others. You know, maybe there's just a possibility that, Job, this thing is not targeting you, that you're just sort of getting the effects of it. But now... Now all that goes out the window. It's pretty clear who's being targeted now. It's Job in the crosshairs of this trial. And so she comes and she reasons with him. How long, she says, will you retain your integrity? There's certain words I want you to pick up on as we go. And one of these is this one, the word integrity. It's a Hebrew word, tuma is how we would say it. And it is a word that carries with it a couple of meanings. One of those is innocence. How long will you claim innocence? How long will you plead not guilty? The other meaning along with it, that's wrapped up, well, integrity, sometimes we mean it puts together. You know, we have an integrated society, the parts are put together rather than segregated, has that meaning. But for our purposes, it really has two meanings when it comes down to the moral realm of things. Your innocence and your adherence to a principle. In this case, the adherence to the principle is his adherence to God. And really, both of those meanings is being wrapped up here in the statement of Job's wife. How long will you retain your integrity? In other words, how long will you claim innocence on your part and blamelessness on God's part? You see what she's saying? How long will you keep this charade up of saying there's no fault on your part and there's no fault on God's part? Somebody's wrong. Somebody's to be blamed here for this. So curse God and die. Go ahead and give Him a reason to put you out of your misery. Just go ahead and end it all. Now, we sometimes think that women talk a lot. They're rather wordy. Just this past week, they discovered a protein they think is responsible. Women have 30% more of this protein than men, and that it is responsible for women being verbal. The old figures you always used to hear was that men in the course of a day spoke about 7,000 words. Women in the course of a day speak 20,000 words. Is that your experience? Don't answer, men. But you know, we generally, you know, we have the anecdotally, that's what we think. And the name of this protein is FOXP2. FOXP2. I thought at first you get it from watching too much Fox News. Makes you verbal, yes. But no, that's just the name of this particular protein they found. But maybe we are giving women a bad rap. I want you to notice here that Job's wife, in one verse, sums up what it's going to take Job's three friends 30 chapters to say. You talk about somebody that gets it, that boils it down to the real meat. Job's wife has a handle on this thing, and she doesn't beat around the bush. Give up your integrity. Give up this notion that you and God are both blameless in this thing, that you're both innocent. Somebody's done wrong here. Somebody's to be blamed. Somebody is at fault for this to have occurred. And that will be the dilemma. As I say, it's going to take his three friends 30 chapters to try to voice this. But that is the horns of the dilemma that Job is going to find himself impaled upon. How do I plead innocence, and yet God being blameless in the situation that has befallen me? That's the problem. And yet Job does not give in. We oftentimes, as I mentioned and read a moment ago, Job 1:21, one of the greatest statements of faith you'll ever find. Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return thence. The Lord gives, the Lord taketh away. One of the greatest observations and statements of God's sovereign will and choice that you'll ever find. There's a greater one here. We overlook this one, Job 2, verse 10. He says to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil?" And I know that's a good statement, because this next statement says, in all this, he didn't sin. He's right. He's right on target. But notice what Job is saying, and this goes a degree further than what he said in chapter 1, verse 21. Because in chapter 1, verse 21, where he's talking about the Lord giving, the Lord taking away, he's talking about good things. I had nothing when I came into the world. God gave me a bunch of good things, and now God has taken it away, and I'm going to have nothing when I leave. Notice the presumption is that God has given us blessing after blessing after blessing, and that's true, isn't it? We didn't have it, we didn't deserve it, and God has showered these blessings upon us. And so if in God's sovereign will, He wishes to take those things away, how can I complain? I didn't deserve them in the first place. He had no reason to give them to me then. So yes, if God gives me wonderful things and then takes them all away, blessed be the name of the Lord. I got some blessing for a little while. This goes far beyond that. Because notice, this just doesn't address the good things that come. It also addresses what he calls evil, calamitous things. You see, it's one thing to say, well, God can give me good things and then take them away because I didn't deserve them. But here we're talking about something else. That God in His sovereignty also has the right to give evil things. And I know that's true because it says right here, when He said that, He didn't sin with His lips. He's right on target. Do you believe that? Now, it's one thing to say we believe that. I mean, we have a hard enough time convincing people that good things that come into our life came from the hand of God. And that He either give them or withhold them. For instance, faith in Jesus Christ. We have a hard enough time convincing our Arminian friends that it's due to God giving you the gift of faith that you believe on Jesus, that you're going to heaven. Right? And He can give it or withhold it. It's in His hands. He can give His gifts to whom He pleases. We have a hard enough time doing that. But now we're dealing more. You know about treading on thin ice. Talk about treading on people's emotions. Now we're talking about God bestowing evil, calamity, ruin, Job stuff. It's easy to say these things. But as Job is going to find out, much, much more difficult to live by this principle. And here's where the real test. Do you really believe that, Job? Well, round two's over. Job hit another one out of the park. It's 2-0. But there's another round coming. And it's going to be the hard one. It's the difficult one. And it involves Job's three friends. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. His friends who are also noted men, great men, rich men, prominent men, who have heard of Job's calamity. And they have come to comfort him. He will say a little later, what miserable comforters you are. Physicians of no value, he calls them. You came to doctor, you came to put the salve on the sore, and you have just ripped the scab off. But they have come to help him. Now, I don't want... These guys get a lot of bad press, or like Job's wife. And let me say, we need to at least observe something here. They cared enough about Job to show up. Not only did they show up, but it wasn't a quick in and out meeting. They came and they sat with him for 7 days, and they identified with him. They sat there in the ashes, ripping their clothes and pouring ashes on their heads too. So these are men who are faithful friends to Job. And let's put it this way. They mean well. They mean well. But in the end, they will do nothing but increase the torment of Job. They will have no answer to what's going on. Well, that's our text. Let me make just a few observations. Again, as I stated last week, again, we see the sovereignty of God woven throughout this whole story. The sovereignty of God is seen in the encounter of God with Satan, that Satan can only do what God allows him to do. He is no equal. There is not this good God and this bad God, and the two of them are dicking it, you know, out there going at it, this city, seeing who can overcome the other. There's not this good principle and bad principle, no light and darkness the Eastern religions talk about that are somehow fighting each other. Satan is completely under the sovereign control of God Almighty. He can go this far. He's like a dog, a mad dog out in your backyard, but he's on a chain. And he can go as far as that chain allows him, and when he hits the end of the chain, that's it. He can go no further. We see that again. We see it with Job. It's interesting that Job sees his calamity as coming from the hand of God. The Lord gave, the Lord take away. We receive good things from God. Shall we not receive evil things from God? Do you understand what I'm saying? Job sees very plainly that the one who has done this to him is God. Even Job's wife believes in sovereignty. She doesn't say, curse the Chaldeans and the Sabaeans and die. She doesn't say, curse the lightning and die. Curse the weather, the tornado, and die. She says, curse God and die. Do you understand what she's betraying there? A belief that it is God who has brought these afflictions upon Job. Job sees it, and so does she. But it's that which creates the test, isn't it? Norm Geisler, you know, some of you all know who Norm Geisler is, was relating a story of where he had a debate in his classroom. He and John Gerstner. Gerstner is a well-known reform guy who was Jonathan Edwards' biographer. And they were teaching at the same institution at one point. And Gerstner is telling the story about the day that he invited Gerstner over. Geisler, there's a lot of G's going on here. Geisler is inviting Gerstner into his class to debate sovereignty. It's an interesting story. And in his account, he mentions how he heard a preacher one time who had lost his son at an early age say that he was completely bent out of shape for years and years till he finally realized that God took his son. Or as he put it, God killed my son. And Geisler makes sort of the witty repartee, well, I suppose if he had a daughter who had gotten raped, he'd have said God raped his daughter. But the point is, if God didn't do it, then who did? And you think you're solving problems by denying God's sovereignty over evil. You think that's going to fix it for you. And in fact, what you're doing is opening up Pandora's box to a whole lot more problems. Because number one, if you believe like Geisler certainly believes that God knew what was going to happen and God was powerful enough not to have allowed it to occur and still went ahead and permitted it, you haven't solved a doggone thing by somehow saying that, well, God doesn't do those kinds of things. And that at the end of the day, the only thing that can possibly give me any comfort is for reasons known not to me, God chose this. The will of God be done. That's where Job is. God gave, the Lord took away, blessed be the name of the Lord. I may not understand it, I may not get it, but I can rest in the fact that there's a God in the heavens who's too powerful to be thwarted, too wise to make a mistake, too good to be evil, and that what He does is right. We may wiggle and squirm trying to escape the totality of God's sovereignty, but the bottom line is this, either God is sovereign over all or He's not sovereign at all. He is doing the best He can do with what He's got to work with, just like we are. But at the end of the day, His purposes, His plans, His prophecies are just guesses, prognostications. And He can only do what men and devils let Him do. Folks, that kind of God is not worth worshiping. Because if He's not in charge, you tell me who is. That's who I want to worship. If it's Lady Luck, let's worship Lady Luck. If it's fate, let's sing Amazing Fate, how sweet the sound. You understand? And notice that there is no ambiguity here. These people believe in a sovereign God. If anyone ever had the right to say the devil did it, they had the right to say it because the devil did it. But they saw the devil was just the instrument in the hands of a sovereign God. Secondly, and this is perhaps the most important thing I will say this morning, because I think this is the heart of the issue. I want you to notice what God says to Satan. In chapter 2, verse 3, we get some insights into the thinking of God, the thinking of Satan, and the thinking of man right here. Job chapter 2, verse 3. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that fears God and eschews evil? That's just what he said back in chapter 1. But notice what he adds. And still he holds fast his integrity, although thou moved me against him to destroy him without cause. We're going to go through the rest of the book trying to figure out what the cause is. Why is Job suffering? We have the testimony of God Almighty that Satan is moving him to destroy Job without cause. Now we have to be very careful here to understand what God is saying. It is a Hebrew word, kinam, that is translated here, without cause. Now what does that word mean? I want to impress upon you that this is not saying that it is absolutely without cause. Because if it's absolutely without cause, then it's completely arbitrary. A causeless choice. Sort of an oxymoron, isn't it? If you make a choice, there's a reason you made that choice. But this is not just a roll of the dice. There is a reason. There was a reason why Job's children died. A storm came up and blew the house down on them. There's a reason why the storm came up and blew the house down on them. Satan raised up that storm. And there's a reason Satan raised up that storm. God allowed him to do it. Do you understand? It's not causeless in the ultimate. To say that would simply to say this was just an arbitrary thing that happened. No, there was a reason these things happened. And the reason is with God. And it is clearly the glory of God that is at stake in this contest. And we see that as he points Job out to Satan. Have you considered him? You've moved me against him to destroy him without cause. And still he retains his integrity. God is bragging, boasting about his servant Job. There is a sense in which we, our duty, is to glorify our God. To promote His glory. And part of that is when we do things like Job is doing here. So it is not arbitrary. Ultimately, there is a cause. God's glory, God's honor. My point is that there is no cause found in Job. You see the difference? Yes, ultimately there's a cause. But is there any reason in Job why these things happen? Is that some fault, some defect has been detected in the character of Job, and so these things are happening to him because of those faults. Right? What he's saying is, no, I am not moving against my servant Job because of some fault defect in him. Here's the point, and I'll assert it again. Satan is a legalist. I think Satan sometimes gets a bum rap. Now that sounds like a strange thing for a preacher to say. But I just want you to notice the picture you're given of Satan here is quite different from the popular opinion of Satan, that someone possessed by the devil is like the Gadarene maniac running around naked in the graveyards, cutting himself, doing crazy things. Or somebody possessed by the devil is shooting, you know, serial killers, killing innocent people, child molesters, rapists. That's sort of our perception, that he's this horrible beast, this horrible thing that indwells us and causes us to do these horrible things. I want you to realize the picture that you're getting of Satan in not just this text, but you'll see the same thing over in the book of Zechariah, and you will see the same thing in the book of Revelation, chapter 12. That Satan is acting here in the guise of what we would call a DA, a district attorney. I said Aaron Burr last week. I was talking about Perry Mason. Aaron Burr, you know, was the vice president that shot and killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel. Slip of the tongue. There's a lot of Burrs. There was, of course, Raymond Burr that played Perry Mason. And then there was Hamilton Burger. He's the one that I was referring to. You know him from the Perry Mason reruns. Some of us saw them first time around, but from the Perry Mason reruns, he's, as some people said, he must have been the most incompetent DA that ever walked upon the face of the earth. Never won. Never ever pinned anything on anybody. Perry Mason always got them off. I'm telling you that Satan is acting here. The picture in heaven, God on His throne, He's the King who is rendering judgments. And Satan has gone before the throne of God to try to pin a charge on Job. He's the DA. Notice the question. Where have you been, Satan? What you been up to? What does Satan say? Well, I've been going to and fro in the earth and walking down in it, roaming, cruising. Well, what are you looking for? What are you roaming around for? What are you doing out there? My friend, it's like the highway patrolman who's out cruising. He's looking for the bad guys. And he's got his stakeouts, his minions that are watching sinners sin. And when they sin, what is his title? He's the accuser of the brethren. He's right there before the throne of God to make accusation against sinners because of their sin. He is not amoral, he's hypermoral. He is obsessed with making sure you and I don't get away with it. Because that is his grip, after all, on sinners. We are under the dominion of Satan, says Paul in the book of Romans, because we're under the dominion of sin. The DA has us in his hooks because of our sin. Because if he can catch us sinning, he's got us. We're goners. He is the destroyer of our soul. It is his grip on sinners. And with Satan, legalism is his world view. Now, when I say legalism, what I'm talking about is retributive punishment. Retribution. It is a principle that drives him. And we see it very plainly in this text. Once I say these words to you, I hope the light comes on. And every time you read this, you say, aha, I see it now. I see exactly what that preacher was telling me. It is his philosophy. It is his worldview. It is his religion. And that religion is the world religion. It's that which permeates natural man. He thinks in terms of legalism. Retributive justice. Now, we think that for folks to be possessed by the devil means they're running around doing crazy stuff or bad things, right? Jesus, in John the 8th chapter, if you don't believe me, you go back and read it for yourself. In John the 8th chapter, Jesus speaks to a bunch of good religious folks in Jerusalem and calls them children of the devil. Ye are of your father the devil, and his lusts ye will do. These are high upstanding Jews of his day in downtown religion there to observe a feast. And he's calling them children of the devil who act just like their father the devil, who do what their father wants them to do. These are fine upstanding folks. Good people. And he calls them under the thumb of Satan. You see what I'm saying? The devil gets a bad rap. You say, well, wait a minute, don't you think the devil destroyed? Well, yeah, that's the byproduct of this philosophy, of this religion. Utter ruin, utter destruction. But it's not what he's aiming at. His aiming is to make sure you and I don't get away with it. Let me try to explain. The world. What we call the world. The Bible uses that terminology, especially in the New Testament. The cosmos. The world. Is it good or is it evil? Man, if y'all are unclear about that, we need to go back to square one. Can you love the world and love the Father? No. They are absolutely antithetical one to the other. Now, by the world, we don't mean the birds and the trees and the water and the fish. We're not talking about the sights and scenes and the food and so forth. We're talking about the principle, all that is of the world, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life. Those things. The thing that makes the world tick. We say love makes the world go round. No, it doesn't. This is what makes the world tick. Self. Gratification, self-glorification, self-exaltation. That's the principle. That is the satanic religion of the world. That lost men, whether they're here next door to you in Olive Branch, Mississippi, or whether they're across the sea in the middle of the jungle of Africa, or sitting in the Muslim world in the Middle East, they have all bought into that religion. Hook, line, and sinker. And legalism is what makes it work. That's the principle that undergirds. Because the principle is this. Satan tells you here in verse 4. Skin for skin. Most of the time we just gloss right over that. We just go right on reading. We assume he's talking about, well, Job, to save his skin, will do anything, and certainly that's what he means. But think about that statement, skin for skin. We have a term in law called quid pro quo. Something for something. It is the heart, the foundation of what we call contract law. If I just want to show up and mow your yard for you out of the gratitude of my heart, and I don't show up one week, you can't sue me. But if you pay me, then we've got a something for something, a quid pro quo thing going on. We've got us a contract. We have us a covenant, you see. And if I don't show up when I have promised to show up, you've got a charge against me. You've got something to lay to my account. Something for something, skin for skin. We put it in other terms, tit for tat. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And Satan, in these words, is betraying the way he thinks and the way he thinks you think. And you know what's right? For 99% of the people on this planet, he's got us pegged. He knows exactly how we think. That's why he can come before God and accuse Job. It's something for something. You take away the quid, you won't get his quo. You see? Just quit giving him this stuff. Or let's even turn up the heat a little higher. Let's give him evil things. Now it's not even quid pro quo. I'm not sure what you call this. Now he's being rewarded not with good things, but with evil things. Do you understand the principle? That at the heart of the way Satan thinks, and the heart of satanic religion, is this idea of quid pro quo. Something for something. Skin for skin. And so, he accuses Job of operating on that principle. And to prove it, he sets up a sting operation. You know what I mean. Stephen, you know what I mean. Let's set up a little sting operation here. Yeah, of course, he's not going to curse you when he's got everything going his way. But you bring these circumstances, these situations upon him, and we'll see the real... Now, you don't understand what a sting is that the guy normally is not doing anything bad, but if we put him in the right situation, we can get him to do something illegal that he wouldn't have done if he wasn't in that circumstance. And that's exactly what Satan is saying. Take it all away. Take away his stuff. Take away his health. And he will curse you. Then you're going to find out the real man. Do you understand that Satan's temptations are not that which causes us to sin? Satan's temptations are sting operations. It's putting us in the exact circumstance that brings out what is already in our heart. And so the real question that we're going to be wrestling with for several weeks, is it right, is it just for God to cause a man to suffer kinam, without cause. God says that's what He's doing. You moved me to make Him suffer kinam, without cause, without a reason. That's our problem when we read the book of Job. We keep looking for the reason, and God tells us in the second chapter there wasn't a reason. There's no reason in Job. We're looking in the wrong place for the reason. And no wonder we get to the end of the book and still scratching our head, what in the world was going on there? Is it just? Is it fair? Is it right for God to bring suffering on a righteous, good, honorable man and do it without a reason? I mean by that, no reason found in the man. Be careful how you answer. Because if you say it's not, you have just undermined the gospel. Let me show you how. Turn to Psalm 69. There are three chapters in the Old Testament that are clear prophetic depictions of the cross of Christ. Psalm 22. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? There you have the objective picture of the cross, the scene, the incidents going on surrounding Christ's suffering. Here in Psalm 69 is the second psalm, the second text. And here you see the cross, but you see it from the point of view of the sufferer himself, the subjective thoughts and sufferings. And over in Isaiah 53, there's the third one, and there you have the theological explanation of what's going on at the cross. So there's a variety, but all three speak so plainly and clearly of the cross of Jesus Christ. And look here in Psalm 69. Now, I could have quoted Psalm 35, but Fred already read that this morning in Sunday school. Two places you'll find this statement. One there in Psalm 35, the other here in Psalm 69. Look at verse 3. The sufferer is saying, I am weary of my crying, my throat is dried, mine eyes fail while I wait for my God. They that hate me, kinam. Without a cause, for no reason. They who hate me, kinam, are more than the hairs of my head. They that would destroy me, being my enemies wrongfully or mighty. Then, is this fair? Then I restored that which I took not away. I am suffering kinam, without cause, without a reason. And again, with no reason in me. I didn't do anything to deserve this. And I'm having to pay what others owed. I'm having to pay back what I didn't borrow. I am being required to suffer for something I didn't do, and I'm being required to pay back what I didn't know. Is it going to surprise anybody here to realize that this is talking about Jesus? Oh, we don't even have to guess. Go to John 15. We've switched languages from Hebrew, kinam, now when it's translated in Greek as dorian, which means freely. You see, to us, freely indicates without cost. But dorian really means without cause. For no reason. No reason found in the object. John, the 15th chapter, verse 22, Jesus speaking before He goes to the cross. John 15, 22, the last night He was together there with His disciples in the upper room. If I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin. But now they have no cloak for their sin. He that hateth me hateth my Father also. And if I had not done among them the works which no other man did, they had not had sin. Do you understand what He's saying? They hate me, but they don't hate me for doing good. Oh, no, I put it backwards. They don't hate me for doing evil. They hate me for doing good. I mean, what are you going to hate Jesus for? You're healing too many people. You're going to put the doctors on unemployment. You're raising too many people from the dead. What are the undertakers going to do?
You're feeding too many people with five loaves and two fishes. I mean, what are the grocery stores? I'm thinking what people would say today, but on Fox News. But anyway, that's what we say. You're going to put all these poor people out. Notice Jesus is making it plain. If you hate me, you're not hating me for doing evil. You're hating me for my good that I've done. If you hate me, it's not because of the lies I've told you. It's because I told you the truth. And so he goes on to say, verse 25, but this cometh to pass, that the word might be fulfilled that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause. Dorian, freely, for no reason. For no reason in me. If it is not right, if it is unjust, if it is evil for God to require someone to suffer, kinam, without cause, then it is evil for God to put His Son on that cross because He was suffering kinam. No reason, no cause. No cause in Him, you see. Even Pilate admitted, I find no fault. Right before he condemns him to be crucified, I don't find any problem with this guy. I find no fault in him. Kill him. You see, there's nothing, there's no ground of suffering to be found in him. If he suffers freely. For no reason. No reason in Him. Now, just as in Job's case, so in Jesus' case, there is a reason. The reason is because it is the will of His Father that it be so. The reason is that He might glorify His Father. But the reason is not to be found in Him. The reason He's suffering for what He didn't do, the reason that He's having to pay back what He never borrowed or owed, is not to be found in Him. It is to be found in a higher cause, a higher principle. Turn to Romans. How are we saved? The heart of the gospel, Romans 3:21. But now the righteousness of God without the law is manifested. Could I put it this way? The righteousness of God without legalism? You see, legalism works tit for tat. You get something good, you earned it. You deserved it. You get something bad, you had it coming. But there is a righteousness that is now apart from the law that is manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ unto all and upon all them that believe. For there is no difference, because all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, being justified freely. Dorian! Not without cost, but without reason, without cause. I am being justified for no reason. No good reason that you can point to in me saying He deserved it. He had it coming. Oh, God looked ahead through His telescope and saw me do some good things, so He chose me. No, He didn't. And Satan, my adversary, had come time and time again before the throne of God and had laid charge after charge after charge to my account. He just got through telling us we've all sinned and come short of the glory of God. We had, you want to go to hell, you're going to get it because you got it coming. But if I go to heaven, it'll be because I was justified freely. Freely, without a reason, without a cause. My Savior was put on a cross without a cause, that I might be justified and forgiven without a cause. It's the heart of the gospel. It drives Satan nuts. Because he can't lay a charge to God's elect and make it stick. There's an answer. That's what we celebrate. Got no right, no reason why I should be invited to a table like this. Even if it's just symbols, I've no right, no claim. Whosoever will, let him take of the water of life, dorion, freely, without cause. I come on that basis, on that ground, to partake of Jesus Christ. I turn my back, in theory, my confession on this thing called legalism. That I've got the right to it. That I've done some good things and I deserve to be here. I have turned my soul away from that. And my only hope is that there is something offered to sinners freely in Jesus Christ. Now I say that, and then let somebody do something evil to me and I want their throat. Right? It's a lot easier to say. But in theory, that's what happened to me when I got saved. I gave up my righteousness and laid hold of this other one that comes for no good reason to be found in me. If you're a Christian, we would ask you to examine your heart and partake of this table as a symbol of exactly that. Grace and mercy, the blood, the flesh of Jesus Christ, the sacrifice of what our Lord did, who did it without cause. No cause, no fault found in Him. I, on that same basis, come and receive these symbols of what God has given me freely without cause.